Follow me down this deep, dark hole.
And welcome to New Horror Express, your fortnightly podcast chatting to the best indie talent the horror genre has to offer, as presented by the Morbidly Beautiful Network. I'm your host, Scott Murphy, and on today's episode, I'm chatting to writer-director Tom Lee Rutter about his upcoming film, The Pocket Film of Superstitions. Over the course of the interview, I talked to Tom about the movie's silent film influences, the retro filming techniques he is employing for this movie, and how he is bringing back Dada with this one. Elsewhere in the episode, we chat about a variety of topics, including the close-knit connections of UK indie horror, the turbulent production of his last film, The Day of the Stranger, and working with cult icon Caroline Munro on this latest project. All of which, and much, much more, you can hear right now in my interview with Tom.
Hi, Tom. Welcome to New Horror Express.
Oh, thanks for having me, Scott. Pleasure to be here in cyberspace.
It's good to have you on the show. So we do have you on the show today to talk about various things that you've made in your career. But we'll first start talking about your upcoming film that is currently still filming, The Pocket Film of Superstitions. So for the audience, can you give us a brief spoiler-free synopsis of The Pocket Film of Superstitions?
Yes. Spoiler-wise, there isn't too much to kind of give away because it's basically plotless. It's a series of vignettes about various superstitions through the ages with a narrator to guide us through. You know, it's basically just loads of like quirky and creepy little moments with a roll call of really lovely faces amidst loads of smoke and mirrors. I think that's probably the best way to look at it. It should be just a really quirky and creepy, quaint little arcade little ride through Spooky Town.
And where did the initial inspiration for the Pocket Film of Superstitions come about?
Well, I was going through a phase of watching silent films really late at night before I slept. And they're the perfect kind of films to kind of usher you into dreamland, so to speak, because you're watching ghosts parade around your screen, basically. You know, everyone involved in these productions is now dead. And the film is an artifact of a world gone by, you know. So it feels like you're watching ghosts dance around on your screen. And I love that kind of, you know, it felt like the veil was being lifted and I was between, you know, worlds, in between different kinds of states, dream state and the waking life, you know. And I think silent films really complement that vibe, the ethereal and, the you know, the haunted. So I really wanted to riff on that, just to kind of capture a kind of atmosphere and see if I can replicate the feeling that I get when I watch these films late at night or even dream about them and whatnot. And there's a lot of dream logic being thrown into that as well. So I see it as all related in my own little way sort of thing. And plus, I'm just a huge, huge fan of the Hexen from 1922, Witchcraft Through the Ages. I don't know if you've seen that one.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It's an astonishing film, that is.
I'm aware of it. I've seen clips of it. I've not seen it beginning to end. It's one of the ones on my massive, never-ending watch list of horror classics. I know the one.
Well, you know, people rave about the directors like Murnau and Fritz Lang, and rightfully so, because they are masters, but Hexen, to me, is just, even the structure of that film was just so far ahead of its time. And And it feels like it was actually created by witches and devils as well, which is, it's just amazing. Everything looks so organic in it, you know, looks so legit, you know, because mostly medieval set scenes and they've all got grub on their faces, you know, and it just looks so real. It just looks so earthy, so organic. And I think the silent film aesthetic kind of really complements that, because you're hiding a lot of the falseness, you know. And if everything's kind of really like dimly lit with a vignette chiaroscuros going on, there's a lot hidden, but there's also a lot being highlighted, and it's just a beautiful image. So in short, I just wanted to rip off Hack Hexen and remake it because I just loved it that much.
Yeah, okay. Was there any other, like you were saying, you're watching different silent films. I take it was mainly silent horror films. Was there any other kind
of... Oh, yeah, for the most part, you're looking at another one which blows my mind is L'Inferno, about Dante's Inferno, the Italian film from 1911. I believe it's the first Italian feature film, maybe.
Okay.
That's very possible. But that's incredible because, again, it's like biblical illustrations come to life and you are watching what feels like another world. You know, these like little haunted little portals into different worlds, you know. And it's astonishing. But, yeah, also a big fan of Faust, Murnau's Faust.
Murnau's Faust, yeah.
Epic film, yeah. Plus, it's also just born out of necessity, really, because... I was having trouble with an earlier film, which was a dialogue-based kind of narrative film. And we struggled with it technically in many different ways because we didn't have the right, you know, the resources to have better gear and everything. So I kind of moved into this silent aesthetic and looking into silent films. So I didn't have to worry about the sound so much, just, you know, I could add sounds if I felt like it, because technically we're not in the age of silent films anymore, but it was nice to be able to just not have to worry about the whole of the sound design on all of its many layers. I could just distill it down to a soundtrack, a narrator, and the odd sound effect here and there, you know. So there was the necessity aspect of it as well as just finding images inspiring, you know. And I suppose with The Superstitions, it was an extension of a film that I made called Bella and the Witch Elm, where I tried that out for the first time. Instead of kind of getting your actors to kind of keep coming back and doing the second or third scene and their hair's just grown out and they've put loads of weight on, which is the case in films I have made, I can bring people in for the day, finish them off, and then send them on their way. And luckily I've got a narrator to bring us into the next scene, so it kind of all makes sense. So that's kind of been my little gambit for the last couple of films that I've made now, and I'm enjoying myself, so I don't really plan on stopping yet in that respect.
Yeah, absolutely. And so Bella and the Witch Elm is something I watched as part of the preparation for this episode. I am aware from doing a little bit of reading that there is two cuts of that. The one I saw had narration, but there is kind of pure silent movie intertitle cut version, I am led to believe. And yeah. Are you going to do the same thing with Pocket of Film with Superstitions?
It was tempting to, but I think what I've done is, because with Bella, it was just a case of, well, you know, it's all based on silent films. Even though the film's technically set in the 40s onwards, which is way after silent era, but yeah, I just kind of didn't care. The aesthetics kind of really complemented the feverish, hazy memory, you know, of the story, you know, and now you can't really trust all of what you're being told about the story, because everyone's account's different and it's all based on hearsay. And so it kind of fit that hazy vibe, you know, that, you know, it's all quite a hazy memory. But with Superstitions, I've kind of incorporated silent movie title, you know, text and title font, title cards and whatnot. So I've thrown all that into the mix in this one, and I probably won't do an alternative version this time because it's probably just don't want to be seen to be repeating myself in any way.
Yeah, okay.
But it is just basically taking further some of the, you know, the kind of scenes and styles and content that I was playing with Rebella, just maybe just pushing it a bit further this time, but with a lot more comedy this time.
Right. Okay. Yeah, because the Bell's quite serious from the most part. That's like, you know,
yeah, and this story. One, this, I mean, another big inspiration for the Superstitions is the film version of Sir Henry Rawlinson End. I don't know if you've ever seen that. It's Bibb Stanshaw's audio series of spoken word about, you know, a real batshit mental aristocratic family called the Rawlinsons.
Mm-hmm.
And they made a film of it, which was, you know, on real low kind of film like 16mm film stock, and it was sepia toned, and you could see how low budget it looked, but it looked gorgeous, you know. And that came out in like 1980, so they were riffing on silent vibes themselves then, you know. And I like the idea of films made in the 70s and 80s onwards that were playing with all those old, you know, early cinema tropes and tricks. And that's just got loads of absurdist comedy in it. You know, it's really Dadaist.
Mm-hmm.
And I really wanted to push that, you know. So there's a lot of silliness in the Pocket Film of Superstition. It's a really silly film. The film opens with a title card that says the following film may contain traces of irreverence.
Well, that's I like that.
Well, you know, the people, they know what they're in for then. It's going to be a very silly film. But, you know, striking a balance between creepy and silly, hopefully we got it right.
Is that part of the Pocket Film of Superstitions mandate? It's going to bring back Dada?
Hopefully that would be nice, wouldn't it? I mean, it is like, you know, really riffing on all those old comedians and that kind of comedy that doesn't really exist like that anymore. I mean, it does, but it's a lot more kind of post-modernist now, isn't it? And
that is very true.
When you look at the likes of Spike Milligan and the aforementioned Vivian Stanshaw and whatnot, you know, and the Pythons, they're just a law unto themselves of silliness, you know. And they had their own language, and it didn't even mean kind of clarity to the audience. It kind of didn't matter to them if the audience couldn't get, you know, understand what they're going on about.
That's true. I mean, like, you wouldn't describe a lot of comedians right now as Dadaist. Apart from, I don't know if you're aware of the English stand-up comedian Simon Munnery.
Yes. He did a great... I've seen a couple of his bits online. I haven't ever seen him live, but yeah, it's kind of deconstructive, but also very silly, isn't it? You know?
Yes, it is. I've seen him live a number of times at the Edinburgh Fringe.
Oh, that's amazing. He did a bit on the bit I watched on the net about how he was thinking of giving up sugar in his tea. And he was drinking it and he thought, well, this just tastes funny. And, well, he decided to take the milk out of the tea then. And then he was drinking just tea, kind of unadulterated. And then he realised he didn't like tea.
Yeah, I remember that. That's good. And
he's brilliant.
Yeah, and if you've not seen it, he did a sketch show in the early 2000s called Attention Scum, which only had one series, but can be found on YouTube. And also, I recommend it to all my listeners as well.
I will certainly be jumping on that because I did not know about that. So thanks for enlightening me onto it. I will be looking at it.
Yeah, it had one series on BBC Two and back in like 2001, and I was one of the...
He's just one of those comedians. He was just a bit too... he just never cracked it, did he? Because I suppose he was just too into doing his own thing.
I think, yes. I think very much so. I think there is certain people who are just too esoteric for the mainstream, and but they have their audience, and I'm one of his audience. And
well, he's kind of in that band that would include, I guess, Stuart Lee as well.
Yeah, but... although Stuart Lee has managed to crack a greater level of popularity than
he really has. I mean, you kind of you know, you do see him, you do see a lot of him there, and he's kind of getting his fingers in quite a lot of pies. And he's just the guy that, you know, just like he likes to be interviewed by everybody, and he's always got something to say. And, you know, he's too cool for school, isn't he, Stuart, really?
I love Stuart Lee. I've also seen him a number of times at the Edinburgh Fringe. But this podcast isn't about my favourite stand-up comedians, Tom. It is about your film. So we will cut back to Pocket Film with Superstitions.
Okay, no worries. Yeah, well, to revive the sense of the Dada, I have enlisted a bit of a Dada legend to narrate it, and he goes by the name of The Shend.
Mm-hmm.
The Shend was in a Dadaist jazz punk band called The Cravats, who were actually based in the town next to Kidderminster called Redditch, you know, and really not far at all. And then he kind of went down to London, I think, maybe in the early 80s. And then he kind of fell into acting. And he was in a film called Pervarello. I don't know if you've ever seen Pervarello by Alex Chandon, who made Cradle of Fear. Main characters.
I have seen Cradle of Fear, but I've not seen that one.
Yeah, Pervarello's like the it's a bit like a Flesh Gordon-y type Carry On. Like a kind of steampunk Carry On film with loads of miniatures, quite Gilliam-esque on a budget. And it's just one of those films that, you know, it's just got so much creativity oozing out of it, you know. And Emily
Oh,
Booth,
no, I'm just looking up now. I think I actually have seen it. No.
Yeah, that's it. Emily Booth played Pervarello.
Yes, yes. Yeah. I remember.
Well, the Shend was one of the main characters in that. And then he went on to be in all of everybody's favorite sitcoms as a bit part actor. And, you know, and then he did another band called The Very Things, who did a song called The Bushes Scream While My Daddy Prunes, which is amazing, which is as Dadaist as it gets, really, with an accompanying video. And that's kind of more of a post-punk kind of vibe going on, with Monster Mash vibes going on. So I went to see the Cravats play, and, you know, it was full of their own irreverence in between songs, and his flair for banter and tomfoolery and absolute nonsense. It was just like, wow, this guy is totally on that same page, you know. And I hounded him after that to be my narrator. And after what felt like an age of back and forth, and we've finally been getting onto it now. So I'm really happy to have The Shend narrate the film. He's a bit of a legend. He's one of these guys. He's done everything, you know. So you look into him, Ben, and you'll find that he's done everything. He's been there. I mean, you know, an episode of Men Behaving Badly was on not long back, and there he was. And it's like, wow, who's this guy, and why is he getting about everywhere? You know, but I just want a piece of it. So yeah, The Shend. He's like kind of like flying the flag of Dada silliness for us in the film, and I just felt like it was the natural choice, really, to narrate it.
Yeah, that seems perfect. It's one of those funny ones of like, I don't think I've actually, I'm not sure if I actually listened to the Cravats, but the name definitely rings a bell, so I might have.
Well, they released an album called The Cravats in Toy Town, which is brilliant, and then they released, okay, I think, another album. And then they did some singles on the Crass label.
Oh, right.
And then they kind of just nipped it in the bud in the early 80s. He went off and did The Very Things. And then, like, I think back in 2013 or 15, around that area, they revived the Cravats. And they've brought out two more albums since. And the last album they did, he does a duet on it with Jello Biafra from the Dead Kennedys.
Oh, from the Dead Kennedys.
Pretty amazing.
That's pretty cool.
That is total brownie points in my eyes.
Oh, yeah, no, Jello Biafra, he's a legend, yeah.
Oh, absolutely. An absolute legend, yeah. So, yeah, it's a great tune. I think it's called Now the Magic Has Gone on their second album. And he does a duet with Jello Biafra. I think, wow, so cool.
That's excellent.
So the degrees of separation between me and Jello Biafra now is getting kind of like, you know, it's nice to know, isn't it?
So... Yeah, so that's only like because you know the Shen, and so he knows Jello Biafra, so that's only like 2 degrees. So, like, actually, I'm only like 3 degrees away now. This is pretty amazing. Yeah. This has made my day.
I've branched out to you now, man, and you're now welcome to the club.
Oh dear, I can now tell people that now at parties and stuff. Like, I can connect myself to Jello Biafra. Yeah. I interviewed this guy who had this guy in his film who did the duo with him. It's amazing.
watch them all go really impressed.
Yeah.
Marvel at their faces.
I have some punk friends who'd be excited about that. Most people will just look at me and be like, yeah, what are you talking about? Please leave.
Complete legend, you know. I mean, but yeah, I mean, he brought out his book recently as well, The Shen, and the foreword is written by Henry Rollins, and I'm like, wow, dude. No, he's. I mean, Stuart Lee's in there as well, because again, Stuart Lee likes to get his fingers in all the post-punk pies.
I think he's. Yeah, he's.
He's always got something to say on the, you know, all these bands that have kind of fallen off the wayside a little bit, apart from those who were there at the time, and they're always due for a mining and getting rediscovered. And I think The Very Things is one of those bands, really.
Yeah, for sure.
Check him out. He's got loads of interesting stuff out there, and it's also fun to see him pop up in different films as well. I wasn't quite aware that he was such a prominent actor.
Mm-hmm.
I thought he was just, you know, this guy from these bands, and so I kind of didn't really hesitate in contacting him about it. And then when I saw his IMDb, I kind of got a bit like, "Whoa, okay, hang on a minute, this guy's used to professional sets." You know what I mean?
yeah, for sure. And talking about, you know, some of the other cast members in the movie, you've got other legends in the film, including Caroline Munro and Lynn Lowry. Caroline Munro, most of my listeners probably know from the likes of Maniac and Captain Kronos and Star Crash, maybe. And Lynn Lowry from, like, you know, Shivers and the Crazies. So how did they come on board?
Well, Caroline Munro was just, you know, dream come true day, that was, you know, because my friend Gary Baxter, he's a dude. He came on board the Superstitions film to play the devil, and we literally got him up from London for the day, shot his scenes, got him back on the train, happy days, and then we ended up bringing him back to finish the Western. We worked with him so well, but his lovely other half, Jane, she manages Caroline Munro, and so it was just a natural a case of, well, you know, what are the chances, dude?
Fair enough.
So he put me in touch with Jane, and we negotiated and set up a date. And, you know, it's quite a tough time for Carolyn, because she'd recently lost her beloved husband. And so she was going through a state of grieving, really. And by rights, she could have just said, you know, I can't do this. And I would have been totally fine with that. It would have been, you know, disappointing, but I would have totally understood. But she wanted to, you know, keep her head above the water and pull through and still take on these jobs, you know. And we made sure we just put her mind at ease on the day. We filmed it at a college in High Barnet in London, which was facilitated by good friends Michael and Lou of Feisty Films. I don't know if they've been mentioned to you out of the Horror on Sea mix of filmmakers, but Michael Feisty, you'll have a good time chatting with Michael. They mm-hmm. worked there as okay. tutors. They worked there as tutors at this college, and basically he said we could have the, you know, the green screen room, studio room, to shoot with Caroline Munro, as long as some of his students get to help out for the day, which, you know, was totally cool with me. And there we go. We had a studio in London. There was a total green screen studio that we could just dress up and do whatever with. And it was just easier for Caroline to travel there rather than bring her up to the Midlands. And she just had a few hours with us, really, just shooting. And Then we went to the pub afterwards, which was just so surreal. I'm like, you know, just here sat in the pub with Carol Limerick. And we started watching like little clips of shows that she used to be in. Like there was an episode of the Frankie Hammett show that she was in, where mm-hmm. she was like a French resistance fighter in the war. And obviously, you know, a few loads of double entendres and whatnot. And I'm just sat there going, you know, what was Frankie Howard like? You know, and she'd just, you know, really like kind of like, you know, quietly say, oh, well, it's such a long time ago, you know. But she was just totally so like at ease. And she's the type of lady that just wants to just blend into the crowd rather than being the center of attention, because there's not a diva-ish bone in her body. She is just an absolute dream. She's just a total angel. And she really enjoyed getting involved for the day, you know. And I think it took her mind off it for a bit.
That's cool.
And she was just absolutely awesome. So I'm just so grateful for everyone who helped, you know, pull that day together. And just I got to work with her. Absolute legend. I'll tell you what was funny. As you know, as you can imagine, we brought loads of films for her to sign. Michael brought like a copy of Maniac, and I think he had a DVD of Star Crash and stuff like that. And I couldn't find. I used to have a copy of Kronos, Captain Kronos, but I couldn't find it, so I brought Dracula AD 72. And I don't know if you know the film, but I bought a copy of Don't Open Till Christmas on video. And
I've not seen that one. I've seen the other ones that you've mentioned, but I've not seen that one.
Yeah, Don't Open Till Christmas is just a notoriously bad film. It's a British slasher, and it's an absolute mess because there must have been about, I think there's about three or four different directors on that film.
All
right. And so it was almost like a patchwork kind of disaster, really. And Carolyn Monroe appears in one scene as like a club singer as a favor, because I'm sure her husband was working on it. And I gave her the video to sign, and she just gave me such a dirty look.
As if all the movies I've starred in.
You had to bring this one.
Bring this one. I'm ashamed of.
She signed it without any problems. She was happy to sign it, but she was just like, why did you have to bring me this one?
Did nobody have The Spy Who Loved Me? No?
Funnily enough, no. I suppose that one was just like, you know, we turn our nose up at that. That's a mainstream film, you know.
Yeah.
We like all the crazy.
Go for the genre crazy ones.
Yeah. Yeah, that's it. Go for the genre. Go for the crazy Italian film she did or something. I mean, this is a lady who's, you know, she's dipped her toe in all the different pools, you know. She's done Eurotrash. She's worked like, you know, Jeff Franco.
Yeah.
And then she did like American Sleaze by doing Maniac and stuff like that. And then she did the Hammer Horror. So it's literally been everywhere, you know. It's done such a good range of cult film that, you know, there's a Caroline for all seasons in that respect, you know.
Yeah.
And that was just, I just loved talking to her about all this. And she had, you know, so many kind of cool stories saying about how cool Joe Spinell was, because she'd worked with him like three times.
Yeah. Well, because they worked together on Maniac and the last horror film. And I don't know what the third one was actually. But,
Star Crash. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Star Crash. Yeah. Well, of course.
The last horror film, is that what it's called?
The last horror film.
That was funny. I mean, at the time, I watched that as Fanatic, because Troma put it out, and I remember thinking, wow, this is awesome. And then I thought, well, I'll watch it again as the last horror film, and I forgot how funny it was. It was literally played for laughs, so self-aware and whatnot, and she plays pretty much herself, didn't she, in that one.
Yeah. Because she basically plays herself. She's an actress, she's a famous actress in the movie, and stopped by Joe Spinell's character.
She's obviously really prominent on the convention circuit these days and whatnot. And don't get me wrong, I mean, I'd be more than happy to meet her at a convention, but as someone who likes to tinker with making films, I'd much prefer to, you know, get her in that environment where we could create something together, you know. And I just feel like if these folks are going to conventions, then they've still got it in them to be in films, you know. So I just figured, well, have a day with her where we do a role that isn't too demanding, and it isn't too demanding for me or for her or for anybody. where we could just take our time, get her shots. And basically what we've done is we did the classic shoot her inserts and then finish the scene at a later date with another crew. So we could just, she could be the sole focus of the day, you know.
Yeah, of course.
Get all the coverage that we needed. And yeah, she was just an absolute dream. And then, yeah, and then Lynn Lowry, we got involved, was a completely different kind of how you do, really. Lynn, as you know, you're probably well aware, she's so prominent and hard at work on the indie scene. She's in so many films, it's unreal.
Yeah, she's in a crazy amount of films. Yes, I'm aware, particularly because I also recently interviewed Tony Marden, and she's in his film, The Witches of the Sands.
Yes. Well, I got onto Tony actually regarding this because I knew that he'd worked with her, but he'd worked with her in the capacity where it was just like a kind of online relationship where he'd talk to her and tell her what he wanted, and then she'd go away and shoot it, basically. She contacted me just saying, oh, I'd like to work with you sometime, because I think she's just that kind of smart that she just gets in touch with all the filmmakers, that she just thinks, oh, I can work with him, I can work with him, you know. And 9 times out of 10, they're going to go, wow, it's Lynn Lowry. Of course we want to work with Lynn Lowry. And that's what I did anyway. And
yeah.
And it was a kind of, well, you know, Tony's just worked with her and he hasn't even kind of like, he didn't even film it. She filmed it herself because she's over in the States and he's over here. So maybe I could do something like that, you know. And well, in short, that's what we did. You know, I devised a sequence where she'd just be like a floating head. And all I wanted to do was just film herself, address the camera with like a black turtleneck on and like a black backdrop, just so I can literally just key everything out apart from her head. And then I could just manipulate it how I saw fit just to animate the scene. She kind of couldn't, I don't think she could really get her head around what I asked her to do, because it was just basically reeling off loads of different superstitions and gestures involving the hands. So, you know, I kind of called her character the Handmaiden, and she just did loads of, she gave us loads of spiel about things that you can do with your hands, you know. And then she goes, don't laugh. and she thought, well, you know, I'll do it. That's cool. And we kind of negotiated after that. And I was kind of worried that, you know, because she hasn't got like a camera or anything, she just had her phone. And I just hoped to God that it, you know, was going to be usable. But obviously Lynn being the consummate pro that she is, she did an awesome job and it sounded good and it looked great. So it was just great. You know, it was a completely different experience than working with Carolyn, because it was literally over the internet.
Yeah, right, of course.
But we kind of tailor-made it so it kind of works in spite of that. And hopefully that's how it plays out, you know. But yeah, I'd love to kind of get a couple more of the Scream Queens in there who've kind of grew up watching and stuff like that. But it's just getting to the point now where I can't keep spending more and more money. I've got to finish the damn thing and try not to ruin myself.
And how far into filming are you with this project?
I think we've literally just got like 15% left to film now, which, you know, so the bulk of it is done. I mean, the reason this has taken so long is because I weren't at a point where I wanted to go the crowdfunding route or anything like that, because I felt like I needed to build up more of a portfolio that I was happy with, and with happy work comes more confidence to ask for the means necessary to make a better film. And so I just self-funded it out of my own wages, really. And because it's mostly a period set film, well, throughout different periods, it would require period settings and costumes and this and that. And so every sequence costs money, basically. And so I can only afford to do one or two a month. That's obviously slowed down in the last year or so due to obvious reasons.
Yeah, obviously.
So, you know, it's trying to pick up that momentum again, really. We did a really good couple of scenes last month. We brought Danny Thompson in to do those. She played two parts. She plays a vampire in one of them and a girl being pursued by a witchfinder in the other one. So got a bit of witchfinder general in there. So that's cool. And cool. We had like 4 hours to do two completely different scenes with Danny playing two different characters, and we just about managed. But Danny's excellent. I mean, it's so good to have, like, you know, the current wave of Scream Queens represented in the film, as well as the old classic.
Yeah, I mean, she is hard at work. Like, I interviewed her recently, and like, she has got so many kind of upcoming projects, and just like, and she does like a bunch of other stuff as well. Like, I don't actually know where she finds all the time.
No, it's insane. It's so inspiring. Yeah, I mean,
yeah, absolutely.
I think she just knows which horses to back to, you know, because obviously if the films do well, then it's more content for her to promote as well, and you know, and it works vice versa. It's just a really good kind of trade-off, really, in kind of helping each other up the ladder, so to speak. You know, she's done, yeah, so much stuff. It's amazing how much stuff gets made, isn't it, really?
Yeah, it's pretty incredible.
And it's all, again, you look at one project and you can guarantee that you can join the dots between each project that you look at, that, you know, it's all involving the same pool of people, or people who've worked with the same pool of people. It just feels like such a tight little scene, really. In comparison to, say, what, you know, you get in America, and although obviously the size is completely different, it feels like you can cover the British Isles in horror, indie horror.
Yeah, I know what you mean. And I mean, like, I've been in recent times kind of connecting the dots, you know, before we were recording, I was saying, you know, I'd interviewed like Martin Payne recently, and Danny Thompson, and MG Dixon, and, you know, the Ice Cream Film guys, and Tony Marden, and, you know, like, yeah, and is Sam Mason Bell from Trash Arts, and you're all connected together.
This is kind of how it works. I mean, so we had Martin come to Kidderminster so he could be in my friend Baz Hancher's latest film, which is a really kind of grim and raw kind of British take on the giallo called Hey Little Rabbit. And Martin's got a particularly gnarly scene in that. And I put him up at my house. And obviously whilst he was staying, we obviously, you know, necking the beer, and he was showing us loads of Sam's stuff, the trash art stuff. And I was like, wow, they make how many films a year? Because Sam and the gang, they're so unbelievably prolific. I was just taken aback at how prolific they were. And I thought, well, I want to get involved with that, you know. So obviously after Martin showed me that, I got in touch with Sam. I ended up going down to Portsmouth and did like a cameo in one of their films, a little part in their film Decline. And then just chilling out with them, just generally just helping each other. And literally, that's just how it's been working, you know. And, you know, you mentioned Tony Marden. I've got a little bit to film for his film, which is of the Sands. Because I guess, you know, you've got to kind of, you see all these different circles whirling around next to each other. So why not just collect them all up?
Yeah, absolutely.
Represent them all in your project, because then you're kind of representing so many different circles in one project that it's also going to have the scope of interest that will travel further afield. And also, it brings people together, you know. And obviously, if all these people were to turn up at a premiere, for instance, and then the people who wanted to work with the other people in the film finally get to meet, and hopefully that can initiate that process.
Yeah,
it's almost like it's all for the greater good, really, in that respect, because it's just nice to be able to connect people and watch them create things together and stuff.
I like this. So you're in the Witches of the Sands as well.
Yeah, I don't think. Who isn't? You know,
I don't know. Like everybody, like I'm. I mean, I've mentioned this on the podcast a few times now. I am so intrigued to finally see this movie, because I've talked to the director of the film. I've talked to the Ice Cream Film guys who are the editors of the film. I've talked to the Martin and Danny who star in the film, and nobody knows entirely what the film is about. But you know, it's got a lot of stuff in it. It's got a lot of stuff in it, and it sounds very interesting.
I'm not kidding. It is probably the one film I am looking forward to the most, just purely because of what you said. I haven't got a clue what to expect, other than that it's going to be batshit mental, and
That I do know, yes.
It's got like an all-star cast, a ridiculous cast. I mean, the Greasy Strangler dude's in it. I mean, I was like, wow, yeah. how did that happen? But it's awesome. I haven't got a clue how he's going to pull it all together, which is part of the filmmaker in me just wondering how it's all going to piece together. And then the film fan in me just quite excited that it, because it does definitely pose, as something quite original. It does sound like nothing else around.
Absolutely, it does.
And, I have been chatting with Tony and we do kind of share a little kinship really, because, with me doing the Superstitions and him doing the Witch of the Sands, they both share the kind of, the flair for that Python-esque kind of humour, as well as kind of period set pieces and again, mostly the same cast members and stuff like that. I see there's some parallels there. It'd be nice to kind of put them head to head once they're both out there and see how they play together,
Yeah, it could probably make a good double bill, like you say, particularly because they both heavily focus on the occult. They both have a kind of interesting, that kind of interesting, slightly psychedelic look to them. They both, like you say, Danny's in it, Martin's in it, Lynn Lowry's in that one as well, in both films. So, you should make it a double feature.
Yeah, well, we might just do that. I mean, Tony's great, and I think again, he'd attend Horror on Sea and he'd be selling DVDs there. So, I used to buy DVDs off him when I'd go, and then he kind of connected with me online. I didn't realize he was an actor, And then kind of since that was established, you see him starting appearing in more things and you think, oh, right, okay, that's that guy. And then he came out with this film, which was just totally insane. I think like a lot of films, it was just meant to have been like a short little film because, he'll tell you himself, he's not really a filmmaker. And he swears down that this is his first and only film that he's going to make.
Yeah, that's what he said to me when I interviewed him, that he's putting everything into it because this is going to be his one effort.
Yeah, that this is it. And I keep telling him, once that premiere comes around and everyone has such a great time, you'll just think to yourself, okay, when do we do the next one? But he swears down, no, this is definitely the only film he's going to make. And that's totally cool. Fair enough. He's obviously experienced the blood, sweat and tears and the anxiety that comes with it all,
So, coming back to your film, you kind of mentioned there the obvious in terms of the restrictions of, filming the film. In terms of that, how difficult has that been, like working around COVID restrictions, filming, because obviously it's got to be quite difficult.
Oh, yeah. I mean, well, I was just, when you got that niggling feeling in the back of your mind that if you have someone come to your set and then they come up, go away, and then they've caught COVID, that's kind of thing. You just think, I don't want anyone catching COVID on my set because then, that will stain me as a filmmaker and as someone who's careless and irresponsible. So you had all those niggling worries on the back of your mind. And we just kind of bit the bullet the one day and went out and did a big chunk in Cheltenham. We went to the Holst Birthplace Museum, Gustav Holst, who composed The Planet. We went to his birthplace, which is like a Victorian townhouse, really, I suppose. And it was all fully furnished. So you can imagine it's not too big. I didn't want to overcrowd it with people, push our luck. And, we put all the... But then everyone I got involved on that shoot were filmmakers themselves. So it was almost like a bit of a gambit on my part just to cast other directors in the roles just because they knew what it all entailed and they knew the struggle. And plus they wanted to be there and do it, So it wasn't kind of like the idea of enticing people out of their homes into the danger zone. It just felt all natural. But obviously the downside is I've just got very little done. There's so much I should have done by now that's been put on hold and whatnot. So it really is kind of like, grab the time when you can to do whatever you can, really.
And when do you think the film, you said you've got like a roughly 15% left of the film. When do you think the film will wrap?
Well, hopefully by the end of this year. And then that'll give us all of next year to, well, most of next year to get it scored and get it looking fit fit for consumption, you know, and make sure all the little niggly bits are all put right and all that. And hopefully we can take it down to a good old Southend-on-Sea in 2023, if they'll have us, and show it to the world down there and in a state of, you know, pseudo-normality.
But, yeah, hopefully, 2023 will be yeah, all good.
I've stopped, you know, call me a pessimist, but I have stopped kind of hoping for this normality to come so soon, right? Because it feels like it's just going to get crazier and crazier. So I suppose you just got to get on the crazy train and just ride with it, you know?
Yeah, I think we've just got, you know, I'm similar as well. I think you've just got to take each kind of week as it comes, I think, at this stage. Because, yeah, I'm kind of... I think most people are kind of fed up of kind of predictions of, like, you know, last year it was kind of, oh, it'll probably all be done by September, you know. Yeah. Oh, no, yeah. Well, it'll all be done by, you know, next summer, you know, like, it'll be, you know, it's like, talk about it's whatever.
Yeah. Big, massive carrot just being dangled in front of us. I think what really scared me initially is was the idea of the community being taken away from us, you know, because... Mm. What really connects us all is to go out, meet each other, go watch films together at these little festivals and whatnot, and then, you know, go and hop on onto each other's film sets, you know, bond with people who are like-minded, you know. I was just afraid that it was going to just be the end of that, and if it's the end of that, then I just felt like, well, what would be the point in making films then, you know? Because it's all part and parcel of the scene, is to go and meet your friends and meet make new friends and connect with people all on a, you know, on a level. And when it all started to go online, it was a means to an end for festivals, and it was successful for many film festivals to continue doing that, just to keep a presence going and to honor people's selections and whatnot. But, you know, it's not like the real deal, is it? You know, it's not like
true. I mean, from a purely selfish perspective of my podcast, the fact that Frightfest and Grimfest went online turned out to be quite good for me in terms of, like, content. But
oh no, I can imagine. Yeah, I mean, the thing is that there have been a lot of virtues in it all. Again, going back to working with Lynn Lowry, I don't think that would have been initiated if it hadn't have been for lockdown, you know. Things have come out of it and we have adapted, and, you know, a lot of people have been producing some amazing podcasts as well, because it's been one of my favorite things is to go and is to listen to the podcast while I'm working. And I think people have been spending more time on making sure they deliver really good podcasts because they've had the time to do it, you know?
That's true. I mean, in lockdown, this podcast went from being fortnightly to weekly.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah. And I suppose it kept you sane as well, didn't it? You know?
Yes. Well, yes. I actually started a second podcast as well, which is now it's now taking up a lot of my time.
Well, but, they've taken down the restrictions. You've got to kind of get back to your normal life, but you've also got to juggle all this work that you've started.
Yeah. But it's fine. It's fine. It's all fun.
But no, so, is it? We need it to get by, don't we? You know?
And you've got your film. You've got film to do it with, and
that's
your
it. Obviously, things. You know, when filming is quiet, then I'll just get back on the timeline and just tinker with scenes that have been edited and just, you know, tweak them. Keep dipping myself in there just so I can get a, you know, dip in the well of creativity to see if I still got the buzz for it. And, you know, luckily it's still there. The buzz is still there for it.
So, as we kind of, I take it, you know, like, you're not working on anything else. It's purely focusing on the pocket films of Superstition.
Well, I'm really fighting the urge to start another film.
Right. Okay.
Because, you know, folk like, you know, good old Sam Mason Bell and whatnot, you know, he'll have a few on the go at the same time. And that was something that I used to do myself. But then sometimes it'd be like, you know, trying to throw balls in a target, you know, you'll throw like three balls and one of them and make it through. So sometimes some of these projects didn't really kind of get finished, and then others did. And then, you know, like like the Western, they just become monkeys on your back that needed to get finished, but you know, you kind of had a real troubled relationship with them that you didn't want to finish them. And then I thought, well, you know what, I really need to stop kind of starting things, I need to start finishing more things. So, you know, the pocket film is quite a big kind of ambitious little project, really, that it's got so many different sequences that I've had to start opening separate timelines for them, just because the amount of effects that I put on certain sequences, it overloads it, and then, you know, I have a bad time of the editing, the Adobe Premiere crashing on me and stuff like that. So I have to break it all down into separate timelines, and so I haven't really got room to start anything else yet.
Okay.
You know, I would like to juggle a couple of films again in the future, maybe. But we'll see how it goes.
Not in the moment.
No.
Yeah, and you've mentioned your Western a couple of times. We're kind of getting towards the end of the interview, but I do like to do something in interviews of confirming IMDb trivia. So Ooh. On the IMDb trivia of the Day of the Stranger, which is your Western, which is out now on Blu-ray, and I think you can see it on Dark Side Releasing and Redemption, and if people want to check it out. And yeah, on the IMDb trivia, it said it received praise from Alejandro Jodorowsky himself. Is that true?
It's kind of half true, yeah. Well, yeah, I sent him a clip and a few stills on Twitter, and he responded. He says he really likes the images, and you have talent. And I thought, wow, I'm totally taking that as praise from Alejandro Jodorowsky.
Well, fair enough.
You know, I could adapt the tweet into a kind of quote on the poster, but I think that might be pushing it too far. You know, but he is, you know, he is the master. I felt very that gave me a glow.
Yeah, I can imagine. Yes, El Topo and Santa Sangre rank wow. amongst my favorite, for the Holy Mountain as well.
likewise. I mean, Santa Sangre changed my life when it came to watching films. It was just wow. It was like watching Psycho on acid. It was Fellini had made Psycho, you know, what a film.
Yeah, it is. It's one of my all time favorite horror films. It would be in my top 10.
Oh, easily. Likewise. Incredible piece of work. Beautiful piece of work. I mean, El Topo as well. I got the same out of that. Totally life-changing experience. The Holy Mountain, I absolutely adore it, don't get me wrong, but it was just so far out. That it was almost like, you know, it did settle down into a narrative towards, like, you know, the halfway mark. But the first half is such a bombardment of crazy, crazy fucking sequences that, you know, you're just at a loss to kind of start making sense of it all. Whereas at least El Topo and Santa Sangre, you followed a hero's journey, or, you know, a troubled hero's journey sort of thing. And you could kind of see what was going on, even with all the surrealism in, you know.
Yeah, that's true. Even though El Topo does kind of feel like two films for the price of one, of like you've got like a kind of spaghetti Western, and then the second half is a Christ parable, and you're like, oh, okay.
Totally, yeah. I think those three films, they're all kind of films of two halves, really. I mean, Santa Sangre has got such a hallucinogenic first half. It almost feels like the second half's like the acid's just peaked and it's wearing off kind of thing. And it's almost like there's more clarity being kind of coming into focus of him, you know, realizing what he's done, you know, sort of thing. Like Phoenix, you know, things start to become clearer. It just feels like, you know, it starts to dip into a kind of more, well, I'd never say realist, because you've even got the scene where all the ghosts just rise from the graves in the big back garden and all that. But it just feels like, yeah, it's all the dream's kind of over and he's just waking up. It does feel very different to the first half.
Yeah, that, like, you're absolutely right on that. Yeah, for sure. So they all have kind of a kind of two film for the price of one. And I mean, like, yes. Also, if anybody's not seen it, you know, yes, The Holy Mountain is, even for a fan of surrealist cinema, it's a lot of movie.
it's the daddy of psychedelic cinema. It has to be said, but you know, you got to work for it. And it was actually when Vision Video re-released Drillicula on VHS. I think like early 2000s or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
They put a roll called the trailers on at the start of the video, and the Holy Mountain was one of them. And it that trailer alone was the first thing I'd ever seen of Jodorowsky, and it just blew me mind. I was like, what on earth was that, you know? And I went to find out for another few years, you know. It went until the Tartan releases came out that I finally watched it.
Yeah, I think I was probably around the same time as well, yeah.
And then amongst those trailers, I mean, a lot of those trailers from the start of that video ended up becoming like favorite films, because you had The Holy Mountain, you had Possession.
Oh, that's an incredible film. That would also be in my horror top 10.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, looking at my shelf now, they're all sat together. You've got Possession, Santa Sangre, Bad Boy Bubby, The Ninth Configuration. These are all those, like, you know, those are the classics that sit at the top, you know. I think it's because they all just encapsulate so many genres. You can't just pinpoint what it is, can you, you know?
Absolutely. The Ninth Configuration is also in my giant watch list of horror classics I've not yet seen.
Dude, you need to see that one. Seriously, it's so good.
I will definitely check that out. But, it has been an absolute joy to have you on the podcast, Tom. Is there anything, before we go, is there anything you want to tell the listeners, that you don't like, fire out any social media details or anything, promote something, or, you know, just whatever you want?
Well, you know, just keep your eyes and ears peeled for the Pocket Film of Superstitions, but don't hold your breath, because it might take longer than planned, as is always the case. But just keep following me on the social media, then you'll get all the updates you need, really. And just keep watching amazing films, you know.
always good advice. But yes, thank you very much, Tom, for coming on, and come on again, and you know, when the Pocket Films of Superstitions is out and I've seen it, and we can talk about the movie more.
That's a great idea. Thanks for having me, Scott. It's been an absolute pleasure, mate.
That was my guest, Tom, there, who I'd like to thank once again for coming on the show. And as always, I'd like to thank you, listener, for checking out this latest episode of New Horror Express. And remember, if you like what you heard, be sure to rate, review, and subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and Stitcher. Also, if you can make those reviews a 5 stars, that would be great, as otherwise the algorithm gets all angry. So we wouldn't want that now, would we? Unfortunately, that is all for this time. But be sure to join me again in a fortnight, when I will have another great guest from the world of indie horror. Until then, though, see ya.